Coming up on Tech Nation, fighting inflammation in many ways in response to insults such as physical accidents, surgery, and even stress, or simply the fact of aging. I speak with Dr. David Beers, the president and CEO of Halea Therapeutics, about their groundbreaking work, both in inflammation and in another drug to potentially resist Alzheimer's. Then Melissa Seveny takes us back to the 1930s with her book, Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take Five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In 2010, I spoke with UC Berkeley professor Ken Goldberg about a project he was working on with the U.S. State Department called Opinion Space. I needed him to be clear. The U.S. State Department wanted my opinion?
Yes, they do. Actually, it's a very exciting development. Because
they didn't want it before.
They didn't really, well,
oh, they
no.
did, but they had no way to get it.
Well, part of it was Obama and coming in with an agenda to really be much more inclusive, politics 2.0 and all of that. So Hillary Clinton was very interested in casting a wider net, really getting ideas, not only from the diplomats and the experts, but from everyone worldwide.
Not just Americans, everybody worldwide.
Exactly. So it's a very bold, in some way, I think, it's a risky idea to sort of open the doors and see what comes in. They've had a blog for about, but it's very heavily edited.
But the problem with the blog is that there's all this text and everybody's got to read all that stuff. To get to the essence of it, you need other tools. And I guess that's where Opinion Space comes in.
Right. So one of the things we're excited about is that lists don't scale well. So the example we give is that Mark Zuckerberg gave an announcement about Facebook a couple months ago, and he got 35,000 responses.
He's still reading them.
Yeah, exactly. We calculated it would have taken 8 days of reading to just get through that list. So nobody's going to read those. And one of the things, so many of the websites now have, it's participatory. Web 2.0 is about participating, so everybody's submitting their comments. But we don't have tools to manage those very well. So we got interested in the idea of how to apply visualization tools and multidimensional visualization to addressing these problems.
Okay, so if I go out to state.gov/opinion space, what do I see?
Okay, so you come to a site that...
Which is the Department of State site. It's a
right.
State Department site.
Right. So it's on their website, and what you do is you can immediately participate by expressing your opinions on 5 topics. And those have to do with the empowerment of women, the role of nuclear proliferation. And the way you do that is different than just a binary checkbox like a questionnaire. We're interested in the idea that you can move this. Your response is a continuous value.
So it's a slider.
Right.
Strongly agree to strongly disagree. And they all start in the middle, like, ambivalent.
Right. And then you click go. And you come to a visualization that shows you where you stand as a point in a... Well, the metaphor is a nighttime sky. You're a star in a galaxy of all the other participants.
So they take the reaction, the slider reaction to each of the 5 questions and somehow come together into who agrees with you, who doesn't agree with you.
Right. So the idea there is that as you express your opinions, you define a point in a 5-dimensional space. And so what we use is techniques called dimensionality reduction to project that down onto a 2-dimensional plane. So that you can see it. But you can show everybody appears in the plane, and the people who you agree with, who have similar opinions to you, will be close to you in that space, and people who are far away will be people that have very different opinions.
So I was right in the middle with this really big circle, and it looked like everybody agreed with me. Are you always in the middle?
No. Actually, that's interesting that you found yourself in the middle. One of the things you can do is once you get to that point, you see the visualization, you can then change your opinions by moving the slider, and you can see yourself move how you would move in the
other
space.
Friends.
Right, right. But the one thing that we think is interesting is that immediately when you do this, you see something interesting, which is that you're not alone.
You've been listening to a 2010 Tech Nation interview with UC Berkeley professor Ken Goldberg. Today, Ken holds the William D. Floyd Jr. Distinguished Chair in Engineering at UC Berkeley. And the Opinion Space address at the U.S. State Department? Well, let's just say the U.S. State Department has gone back to not really wanting my opinion. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we're talking about inflammation, how it's there, and how we know it's being reduced, both over a lifetime and in response to the accidents and incidents of living. Dr. David Beers is the president and CEO of Halea Therapeutics. Then Melissa Seveny tells us about two women scientists in the 1930s who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. Otherwise, an all-male crew. Yes, these gals had to do the cooking.
Tech Nation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Dr. David Beers. Dr. Beers, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Now, everyone is wary of inflammation, whether it's in their joints, in their gums, and wounds, anywhere in their body. And you talk about the inflammasome. That's like inflammation, but it ends with zome, S-O-M-E. What is the inflammasome?
Yeah, the inflammasome is a large protein complex that forms inside of specific types of cells in our body that regulates the immune inflammatory response. And it's something, you know, I'm a cell biologist. I have a PhD in cell biology, and, you know, I've taught cell biology at large universities, and I never have taught anybody about this because it's a fairly new discovery. We actually didn't know this thing existed inside of our cells until just a few years ago, but we're starting to find out that this plays a major role in regulating not just the normal healthy inflammation, but the kind of inflammation that is now associated with a lot of chronic diseases, and we call it chronic inflammation.
Now, the inflammasome is part of, at least what it's made up of, are the red blood cells and the white blood cells that we have, right? Those are all together?
That's correct. Yeah. So the immune cells are our white blood cells in our body. And so when we produce immune white blood cells, they can react to different signals and can propagate a signaling to say to other cells, there's a problem here. It's time to come and fix this thing. And so that's part of our immune system is constantly looking for what we call danger or damage signals that tell the immune system there's a problem. And when they see that, certain immune cells will activate this complex of proteins that will then ask for more help to come, to say more of these immune cells need to come here and need to fix whatever is wrong. So there's an interplay between all of our blood cells and how they get affected. So our blood cells are all produced in our bone marrow, and our bone marrow is inside. It's a tissue that lives inside of our bones, and it's maybe the hardest working tissue in our body. It replenishes all of our blood, both our red blood cells and white blood cells, and even our platelets, which are involved in clotting. It replenishes those every single day of our life. So we're constantly turning over these cells. And so there's this interplay, this connection and interaction between red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, all communicating with each other. And it's remarkable that this works really, really well for most of our life. But just like everything, it's impacted by inflammation. It's impacted by, as we age, it's impacted by our aging as well.
Now, tell me what happens as you age.
Yeah. So, you know, I think all of us, especially, you know, as we get older, we start feeling the effects of it. I tell students all the time when I used to teach classes, there's really no reason at the cellular level why we age. But when we put a bunch of cells together in an organism, we see that every organism that lives on the earth will age. And our tissues, you know, we used to think that aging was just our tissues got tired. They just ran out of juice to be able to do what they were supposed to do, and they quit functioning properly. But aging is quite interesting, and we've learned a lot about it. And one of the areas that I've been focused on is what happens to your blood cells as you age. So as I mentioned, our bone marrow is a hard-working tissue. It's turning over red blood cells and white blood cells every day of our life. And, you know, we used to think, oh, it just runs out of gas as we get older. It's not as good as it used to be. But what we've discovered is as we accumulate damage over our lifetime, you know, these bodies of ours accumulate all kinds of wear and tear. You know, we can feel it as we age. Our joints don't work as well as they used to. Our bone marrow has the same thing happening inside of it. So there are these signals that I talked about, these danger and damage signals that tell our immune system there's a problem here. And as we accumulate that damage over our lifetime, we start to see kind of this low smoldering inflammation. So what we've discovered is that when you're young, your red blood cells and your white blood cells are produced by a lot of cells in your bone marrow. You have these cells called progenitor cells, or we call them stem cells sometimes. And those cells are producing all of your blood cells. And when you're young, there's lots of those kinds of progenitor or stem cells making all of your blood. As you get older, you start to see that one clone, one single progenitor cell line inside your blood is producing most of your blood. And that's remarkable. When we first, as a scientific community, when we first discovered that a few years ago, it was just kind of an oddity. We said, oh, that's kind of weird. You know, why does one cell take over as we get older? But what we've discovered now is it is a part of the aging process that seems to be predisposing us to a lot of other conditions. So when we're young, our bone marrow is healthy. It's producing lots of blood cells from lots of different stem cells. As we get older, one particular clone seems to take over and produce most of our blood. And what we've discovered is that those clones are not normal. And as we age, we start to see accumulation of mutations. And when you have mutations in blood cells, they're not acting like a normal, healthy blood cell should act. And so we're starting to ask the question, what does that mean? What does that mean to human diseases? Is there something significant about that? And I think we can say definitively, there is something significant about it. It's having mutated blood cells is not a positive thing. And as we get older, we have more and more of them.
Now, at any age, if there's a problem with those cells that produce the red and the white blood cells, you have a problem. You have a medical condition. What would be something we're familiar with?
Yeah. So if you can't make blood cells, you know, I think the most familiar thing to everybody is the word anemia. And anemia just means anemia means you have a deficiency in red blood cells. So you're not able to either produce enough red blood cells or functionally, you're not able to make functional red blood cells. So that's, an anemia, we all probably experience anemia at some point in time in our life. Women are more susceptible to it and children are actually quite susceptible to it. But I think all of us are familiar with anemia. And anemia, there's a lot of causes. But as we've started to look at it, we've realized that inflammation in our bone marrow is one of the main causes and drivers of anemia. So when you get inflammation, this inflammatory signaling in your bone marrow, it prevents the differentiation of these stem cells into red blood cells. And so we can see a big percentage of the world's population. We're talking about billions of people, not millions, but literally billions of people every year suffer from anemia. And a good portion of that is connected to inflammation.
Now, I have to say, there's no doubt that you really want this to be working well.
That's right.
And all kinds of things could cause it to not be working well. And when it doesn't, you know, it's related to inflammation, and inflammation drives so many things. But let's look at what Halea Therapeutics is focusing on. What are you focusing on in the inflammasome?
So we discovered a few years ago that the inflammasome, this big protein complex in your cells, needs a lot of different components to come together at the right place and the right time to do what it does. And we discovered that this gets messed up in different diseases, and that's where chronic inflammation, that's where it starts. So we discovered a way to turn it off by blocking the assembly of this complex. And so we have a little drug that we designed it on a computer. We used what's called structure-based drug design. So we solved the structure of this protein that's part of the inflammasome, and we designed a drug to go in and bind to this site on this protein that blocks its ability to form this big complex. And when we do that, we can show that we can dampen the signaling that comes from the inflammasome. And in fact, even cells that have had this complex formed, we can watch that complex go away. And so, you know, it's a general mechanism that's associated with chronic inflammation. And so, you know, when we discovered this, we said, wow, you know, what can we do with this? Where is this important? You know, where should we try it? And, you know, because of my background and things that I've worked on in the past, I knew that there was this very specific bone marrow disease called myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS. So MDS is a type of leukemia that's contained in your bone marrow. And we know that it is completely dependent upon this pathway, the inflammasome, to actually form MDS and to maintain MDS. And so it's a driver of this disease. So I called some of my friends that are experts in this area, some doctors that treat these patients. And I said, what if I had a way that I could turn this thing off? Do you think that we could look at that in human patients? And so we designed a clinical trial where we could take MDS patients. And right now, the way that we treat MDS, by the way, is these patients, because they have such strong inflammation happening in their bone marrow, their bone marrow cannot make red blood cells, and they can't make good white blood cells. And so what happens is, we call it a bone marrow failure. So the bone marrow just doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And the best way that we can treat it early on is we just give people transfusions. So they come in, they're very anemic, they feel terrible. And so we just give them blood. And you can imagine that's not a great way to live your life, having to come in every week and get a transfusion. Some of these people, that's what they have to do.
So you're actually giving them red blood cells and white blood cells, even though they didn't create them themselves.
Exactly. So we just say, well, they can't make them, so let's just give them from somebody else. And so that's kind of how we're trying to treat the disease. It doesn't get at the core of the disease, right? So that's not really an effective therapy, because we're just trying to replace one of the problems. But the real problem, the driver of this disease, happens in their bone marrow, and it's driven by inflammation. So obviously, we studied it in the lab, and we said, well, what would happen if we treated with our drug in a model of this? And what we saw was we could actually differentiate. So we could take marrow, bone marrow, and, you know, we just stick a needle into the hip bone of somebody, and we pull out some of their marrow, and we can grow that in the lab. And so patients that have MDS, we can show that they're not producing red blood cells and they're not producing white blood cells. And then we treat with our drug, and we start to see they're starting to differentiate. And we can see that they can move past that block that happened because of inflammation. So that got us very excited. And so obviously we had to jump through all of the experiments that need to be done to get this ready to go into people. But we're actually treating real people with this disease now. And we're asking the question, what does this do to their ability to make red blood cells if we can turn off inflammation in their blood? And so we're excited about where we're at. We just launched this study a couple months ago. And so we hope by the end of this year, we can release some data and say, this actually has an impact on this disease. And by getting rid of inflammation, we can actually restore the body's ability to produce red blood cells and white blood cells normally again.
So it's almost as if they still have the capability to produce the red and white blood cells, but the structure of the inflammasome, as it gets going, it stops it. It counteracts it.
That's exactly right. So it basically arrests these cells. So if you think about a stem cell, that's an undifferentiated cell. It can become all kinds of things. That's what the definition of a stem cell is. It has the ability to turn into other types of cells. So there's a common progenitor cell in your bone marrow that can turn into white blood cells and red blood cells and platelets. And when you induce the inflammasome and cause this inflammation, it stops it from being able to do that. So if I can take that away, all of a sudden we start to see the ability of these cells to differentiate into red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets.
Couple interesting stories here. One is that so many of us have had surgeries, small surgeries, large surgeries, and around the wound and in our bodies, there's inflammation. There's been an insult to your body. Is that the same kind of inflammation? Is that affected by this?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The inflammation that is triggered by a surgery, your body sees that as the same kind of damage response that it would if you broke your leg or you cut your finger. And so obviously we're going in and we're trying to excise out or trying to fix something that's wrong with a surgery, but we induce all this inflammation. And we used to think, back in the old days, 20, 30 years ago, the old days, right, scientifically, that inflammation, that might be really good, right? I mean, because your body's responding to it, and it's a part of the healthy response to a injury or an infection. But what we've discovered is that most of the inflammation after a procedure is actually not helping with the healing process. So it actually, by turning on this inflammasome, which is exactly what you do when you cause damage, you're actually preventing the healing process. And that's why we try to, put ice on, when we have an injury, is we try to stop the immune response that's happening. And we take, drugs like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or other types of drugs that we've had available to us, but none of those drugs will turn off the inflammasome. And so we're just trying to stop some of the downstream signaling that comes. But until now, we've never had something that could turn off the real driver of the inflammatory response. And so we're super excited about the idea. What happens if we just turn that thing off? What if we stop it? Could we heal faster? And what we've seen in the lab is it certainly looks like we can. So we can go in and do, surgical procedures in the laboratory and show that we can see healing is actually faster when you turn off this inflammasome signaling.
Now we're going to try that in humans?
Absolutely.
Anytime soon.
That's right. So in fact, as we're recording this right now, we're actually treating people today. We just got the first go ahead to treat some people to see what happens post-procedure. And the nice thing about this is we can actually watch what happens in their blood. So after you have a procedure, after you have a surgery done, you will see induction of inflammatory signaling in your blood. You can actually monitor that. So you see these signals go up and we can see what happens. So what we're doing is we're seeing with patients what happens after their surgery when we don't give them their therapy to target the inflammasome, and then what happens when we give them therapy to target the inflammasome, and we see how different that inflammatory response is. And the nice thing from a drug development standpoint is that's a pretty short study. We have a captured population of people that are having a procedure, and then we watch just over the course of a week what happens to their inflammation. And so we can get a readout very, very quickly, which is exciting for us, because sometimes we design clinical studies that take literally years to figure out what's going on. In this case, we hope that we can see a signal very, very quickly.
Now, what are the first surgeries you're looking at?
So we have a very interesting situation that exists where we are located. So our headquarters is in Utah, right south of Salt Lake City. And so the first surgeries that we're doing are actually connected to where we're at in Utah. So we have a population of young individuals that are headed out as missionaries for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormon Church. And all of those missionaries that are going out, they all have to have dental exams, and they need to have their wisdom teeth removed.
Whether there's a problem or not.
Because
we can't handle this if there's a problem when you're somewhere in the world.
That's right. We send them all over the world. They go all over the place. And so it was just decided that prophylactically, it's a good idea to take your wisdom teeth out, because for a young, healthy person, it's one of the things that can actually cause a complication if they're in wherever, in Africa or, wherever. We send them all over the place. So what we decided, and we designed this study to ask the question, well, when you pull your third molars or your wisdom teeth out, you actually cause not just a local inflammation in your jaw where you pulled that tooth out, but it actually causes a systemic inflammatory response. You activate that inflammasome and your whole body says, hey, we've got a problem here. So we're actually doing in literally today, we're dosing patients where we can see what happens if we extract this tooth and we turn off the inflammasome. What happens to the signaling for inflammation? And the implications here are big. So if we can show that we can block, by blocking the inflammasome, we can block that systemic inflammatory response, we hope that leads to faster recovery after a surgery by suppressing inflammation. So we already know that if you can get back to work and get back to, activity quickly after surgery, your outcomes are better. If you feel lousy and you're just laying around for a while, you actually do worse. And so trying to get people back and recover quickly is a really important part of the recovery from surgeries. And inflammation plays a big role in people not feeling like they can get back and get back to normal activity. So if it works there, the next step is, let's see where else it works. Does it work in some of the standard places that we look is bunion surgery, tummy tuck surgery. Those are also very, very captured populations. But even, in knee replacements and hip replacements and very common surgeries that we have all the time, we know that this pathway is activated, and we're very, very interested to see if we can help people recover faster by turning off that inflammation.
Well, I mispronounced the name of your company when we first met. I said Halia, H-A-L-I-A, and I was like, no, it's Halia, which is Hawaiian. You guys are all over the place. Okay,
yeah.
How did we get this name, Halia?
Yeah. I, myself, and one of our co-founders, a Hawaiian scientist, and there's not many scientists from Hawaii, so he's kind of a He's kind of a unique individual, but his name is Keone Kawe. And so Keone and I got together to start Halia with the idea that we could target inflammation in the brain. And we actually discovered this in a very interesting way. So Keone is a human geneticist. So he studies risk factors based off of our genetics. So he looks at variations in genes and what that does to risk for different diseases.
I'm speaking with Dr. David Beers, co-founder, president, and CEO of Halia Therapeutics. We'll talk more after a break. Both entire Tech Nation programs and biotech-only podcasts are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, on the web at technation.com and biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, science journalist Melissa Seveny tells us about two 1930s female botanists who organized a science expedition down the Grand Canyon on the untamed Colorado River. Stay with us.
Oh,
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Dr. David Beers, President and CEO of Halea Therapeutics.
Keone is a human geneticist, so he studies risk factors based off of our genetics. So he looks at variations in genes and what that does to risk for different diseases. So he's looking for, you know, the places in our DNA where we have differences and how that is correlated with our risk for developing different diseases. And his specific interest has been in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And so he came to me and said, hey, I discovered something really interesting. So there's a very well-known risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. It's called the APOE4, and it's a polymorphism, and I guess you could call it a mutation, but it's a different DNA sequence in this gene called APOE. And if you have this flavor of that gene, your risk for Alzheimer's is quite high relative to the rest of the population. So he was studying this, and he actually found a family. And once again, it comes back to Utah. We have large families in Utah usually. And he found a family in Utah that had this polymorphism, the APOE4. But nobody in their history, their medical history in their family, nobody got Alzheimer's disease. So he actually organized a family reunion, got all those people to come, and they all consented to be studied to see why, with this genetics that should predispose them to Alzheimer's, why none of them got Alzheimer's. And so we were able to sequence over 200 individuals in this family, and we discovered they had another unique DNA polymorphism or mutation that actually look like it was associated with preventing Alzheimer's. And so when we started the company, the whole goal of the company was to figure out, well, what does this do? And we started the name of the company, Halea, is a Hawaiian name that means fond memories. And so we started with the idea that we could target Alzheimer's. And in fact, we haven't given up on that. In fact, very, very soon we should be announcing that our second drug that we're moving into the clinic is actually targeting this exact pathway that we discovered and trying to replicate what we discovered genetically in this family with a new drug that can have the same kind of activity. And in fact, it comes right back down to inflammation as well. So what we discovered is this family has a mutation. We call it a resilience mutation because they're resilient to a lot of things. They have less heart disease, they have less cancer, they have less Alzheimer's. And it's interesting that it's due to their ability to have lower response to inflammation. So we're excited about the idea that we can take a genetic discovery and translate that into something that we could actually use as a therapeutic.
You know, here we have Dave Beers, you know, drug hunter, drug discoverer, Dr. Beers, very impressive. And I do have a question for you along these lines. I mean, you have founded 8 biotech companies. You've discovered many drugs. 16 of those drugs have actually moved into human clinical trials. Then I have to tell you, that's an impressive record. How is your current experience with Halea the same, and how is it different from your earlier experience?
Yeah, it's been an amazing career for me. I love what I do. I get up every morning thinking today could be the day we make a discovery that changes the world. And you know, that's not hyperbole. That's real, right? I mean, we can actually find things that change diseases in people, and that's just amazing to me. So when I first started, I was very naive in terms of starting a company, and really my motivation to start a company is I was a professor. I was, you know, in a lab, you know, doing research there, and we discovered something that we thought could be a new therapy that could help people. And I went to a mentor of mine that I learned a lot from and said to him, well, how do I take this from my lab and turn it into something that could help people? And he said, well, you're probably the only person in the world that's going to believe in this. And so if you want to see it move forward, you probably need to do it yourself. And so I actually took the leap and just said, okay. I walked away from a tenure track faculty position at a major research university and just decided I'm going to start a little company. And I barely even knew what a a stock was, a share in a company. I hardly knew any of that. But thankfully, I had a great partner that helped me put together the first company. But, you know, I had no idea how hard it was to raise the money and to go through all the process of getting the supporting information to show that the drug could actually be safe and potentially effective in people. And so I guess what's different about Halea is that I had seven other tries to learn a lot of stuff and make every mistake that you can make. And hopefully I'm not making very many anymore. But I tell people all the time, I earned all the white hair that I have because I've probably made every mistake that you can. But what's kept me going is, you know, I really want to make a difference in people's lives. I lost my grandfather the year I was born, never had a relationship with him, don't know him. I have one picture of me as a baby, him holding me, and that's it. That's all I know about him. And I lost my mom when she was young, both of cancer. And I just decided, you know what, if I can spend my life and make it so other people's moms and grandpas can be around a little longer, that's not a bad life to live. And so for me, that's what keeps me going every day is can I make a discovery that can keep people's grandmas and grandpas and moms and dads around a little longer? And it's amazing to me that we've been able to work on projects that are now approved drugs, things that people use and they have extended the life of people. But it's never enough for me. I want to have number 17, 18, 19, 20, you know, to keep finding the next one. So I'm not going to stop.
Dr. Beer, I'm thrilled that you're not going to stop personally.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for coming on. I hope you come back. Visit us again.
I'd love to. I'd love to tell you the when we get some results, show you what's happened and what the next big thing is.
You're on. You're on. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Dr. David Beers is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Halea Therapeutics. More information is available at haleatx.com. That's H-A-L-I-A, haleatx.com. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Today, Melissa Seveny takes us on an unprecedented science expedition down the wild Colorado River and into the Grand Canyon in the 1930s, before we built all those dams. Her book is Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. Melissa, welcome to Tech Nation.
Glad to be here.
I was eyeing your book when all the current media coverage started emerging about the dams and reservoirs on the Colorado River. Terrible problems. Droughts, too much water, silt. What's the relationship between the Colorado River today and the Grand Canyon?
So much has changed between now and 1938, which is when this book, Brave the Wild River, is set. Really, everything has changed from kind of an ecological standpoint. You know, these big dams have gone up on the river, which, you know, changes upstream. Obviously, you end up with a reservoir instead of a river, but a lot of people don't know it actually changes the downriver section as well. You no longer get these big floods coming through. You don't get the dry seasons where the river would kind of almost vanish away. Instead, the water is very steady and it's very cold. And that has ripple effects in the ecology that really we're still studying and still trying to work out.
Now, take us back to 1938, and that's the time of your book. What was the state or the status of the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon then? I mean, that's 80 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, so in 1938, it was a very kind of wild river, an uncontrolled river. It was just the start of the dam building era. So Hoover Dam, which at the time was called Boulder Dam, had been built, but it was still filling.
And that's downriver from the Grand Canyon.
That's just downriver from the Grand Canyon near Las Vegas area. And so the reservoir behind that, Lake Mead, was just starting to fill up. But there weren't a lot of other dams on the river. So upriver from that point, it was very wild, and the water was very high. The characters that I'm writing about decided to leave on their trip at high summer, really like at the height of the flood water. And so they hit it when it was incredibly high water, the kind of water that we don't see very often today.
Now, you're right that every mile it dropped 9 feet. So you had to be going through rapids and falls, all kinds of things for 1,500 miles.
Right, right. I'm told from people who are more experienced at whitewater river rafting than I am that there's rivers in the United States that are much more steep than that, and, you know, much higher water. But what's unique about this river is, you know, there's these long, long stretches of water where it's very still and it's very calm and it's very peaceful. And then suddenly there are these rapids, and the rapids are mostly created by these tributaries that bring in boulders and sand and dirt. And so they're constantly being reshaped. You never really know what you're going to get when you're approaching a big rapid in the Grand Canyon. So it was really, you know, it's incredible to experience running this river, which I did myself for research for this book. And yeah, it's really an indescribable experience.
Well, all of this is somewhere on the spectrum from idyllic to completely frightening. I couldn't help reading the very first quote you put in the frontispiece of the book. It's quoting Roy Chapman Andrews of the Explorers Club in 1932, just a few years before this trip we're writing about. And he says, "I know of no more effective way to wreck an expedition than to put in one woman, or worse still, two." Now, was this just a coincidence, or was he talking about the two particular women we're talking about today, Lois Jotter and her mentor, Elzada Clover? Who were they?
Right. Yeah. When I found that quote, I knew I had to use it right in the front of the book, because it was so perfect. But it was a coincidence, or maybe it's better to say it was simply the attitude at the time that women shouldn't go off and go exploring in wild places. So these two women, Elzada Clover and Lois Jotter, they were both botanists at the University of Michigan. Elzada was in her 40s. She had a PhD in botany. She was kind of obsessed with plants. That was really her whole life. And she had this dream that she was going to collect cactus. She wanted to make a complete cactus collection, all of the cactus in the Southwest. And so she wasn't really getting a lot of support from her university to do this project. She was out in Utah collecting cactus in 1937 when she met a man named Norm Nevels. And Norm Nevels also had a dream. He wanted to start a commercial river running business on the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. And he had never done it before, but they sit around and start talking and realize that they could go do this together. Norm Nevels could build the boats and recruit some boatmen, and they could go down the river, and Elzada would have a chance to collect her plants. So she went back to the University of Michigan. She knew she had to invite another woman to go along because it wouldn't be appropriate for her.
Wouldn't be proper, no.
Wouldn't be proper for her to disappear into the wilderness with a group of strange men. So she invites Lois Jotter, who is, you know, a dear friend, a student of hers, a former roommate. They were very close. Lois is just 24 years old. She writes this wonderful series of letters to her father before the trip, trying to convince him to let her go, because everyone knew that this was kind of a risky thing to do. Again, long before we had commercial expeditions going down these rivers. And they would be the first non-native women to succeed if they succeeded in that trip. So everyone was pretty nervous about it. But they had this dream. They wanted to get these plants. And so off they go.
Now, I keep going back to the setting for this river journey. At the time, only 12 expeditions had successfully traveled the river. That's 50 men. What were those earlier expeditions doing compared to what these gals were doing?
Right. So there were about a dozen expeditions between John Wesley Powell going down the river in 1869 and my folks, my women going down the river in 1938. So a pretty long stretch of time to just have, you know, a dozen expeditions tackle the Grand Canyon. And I should say, of course, indigenous people in this region have been running this river long, long before that. So the Navajo and the Hopi have stories of people who ran through the Grand Canyon and all kinds of interesting craft. So that history is there. for these women, what they were doing was a little different than what the other scientists and explorers who came before them were doing. So, you know, John Wesley Powell was a geologist. He wanted to do science, but he pretty much ended up just kind of clinging to the boat and getting through. He was pretty disappointed in the amount of scientific work he was able to do. The other groups that came after him were very interested in finding ways to really kind of exploit the river. They wanted to survey for dams or even for a railroad to lay along the side of the river. You know, they had ideas of how this region was sort of going to be developed or used. And what Elzeta and Lois were doing was collecting plants. They wanted to make a scientific survey. And so they were really just interested in understanding what was there, what the ecology was like. And that's a little bit different than what people before them had done.
Now, take us down this river in the sense of they weren't just lounging in boats and occasionally saying, kind of go close to shore and I'll pick up something and throw it in my bag. Tell us what they were doing as botanists.
Right. Yeah, it was a pretty intense journey, more than 600 miles. They started on the Green River from the town of Green River, Utah, and then hit the confluence with the Colorado at the head of Cataract Canyon. And through Cataract Canyon, very high water, very big waves, through Glen Canyon, which wasn't yet underneath Lake Powell as it is today, kind of a nice, peaceful stretch of the river, and then finally into the Grand Canyon. And they ended the trip at Lake Mead. So it took more than 40 days to do that journey. And they spent a lot of time trying to figure out simply kind of how to tackle the rapids. Nowadays, river runners know a lot about how to approach rapids, but they were kind of figuring out as they went, and they ended up actually walking around a lot of them or taking the boats out and dragging the boats around a lot of them because they were quite nervous about handling this high water. And because of that, there wasn't as much time for plant collecting as Elzeta Clover had hoped. That was one of her big frustrations. She was spending a lot of time just trying to help them get the boats downriver. And by the way, the women were doing all of the cooking morning and night. So they were quite busy with these other tasks.
Science and cooking. Yes, yes.
Science and cooking. That's right. Yep. So they ended up having to get up very early and collect plants or stay up very late and collect plants, often after dark. And I was really impressed with how detailed they made these incredibly detailed notes, not just about the cutting they were making, but, you know, the entire environment around it. And what they had to do is they would, you know, they would cut the plant. If it was a cactus, they would have to scoop out the pulp inside of it, and then they would press it between sheets of newspaper. For cactus, you had to keep all of the spines and stickers intact. So you imagine this is a little bit tricky, right?
What did they do? Slice it or something?
Right. You would slice it lengthwise, like if you had a cactus pad, and then you would scoop out the pulp, press it flat, try to make it look as natural as possible, just like it was when it was growing. And then the whole thing would be stacked. You know, you'd get layers of plants and newspapers stacked up, and you'd put it between two pieces of wood, and you'd kind of cinch it tight. And this was called a plant press. So they would create these plant presses as they went down the river. They kept them in the hatches of the boats, which were supposed to be waterproof, but they didn't really turn out that way. So they were really struggling trying to keep these collections kind of safe and dry along the way. And whenever they got a chance, they'd actually mail these bundles of plants back to the University of Michigan because they were so nervous about the boats capsizing or some disaster befalling them that they wanted to preserve this collection and make sure at least some of it got back home.
I learned a little bit about botany I certainly didn't know before because I know so very little about botany. And that's about not just picking a plant here or a plant there and putting it on the map, but looking at plant migration.
Right. Yeah. You know, this was a time, you know, 1938, when the word ecosystem didn't really exist. It had just been invented, but nobody was really using it yet. And so what interested me about their journey was, you know, how are they looking at these plants as part of an ecosystem, even though they didn't have the vocabulary to describe that? And they really were doing that. They were talking about, you know, the soils, the topography, the angle of the sunlight, the effect of, you know, little mice or deer coming along and nibbling on the plants. All of this today we would describe as ecosystem science. But they were sort of just feeling it out as they went along. So one of the questions they had was whether plants migrated or moved along the river corridor. Were they kind of extending their ranges? The Grand Canyon is kind of at the intersection of three different deserts, all with their unique ecology and plants. So they wanted to see if how those deserts were kind of meeting and mingling and moving up and down the river corridor. And that's a pretty, you know, sophisticated question for the capabilities they had, which really weren't much, right? They were busy trying to get down this river and collect the plants, but they still had these big scientific questions they wanted to answer.
And I have to say, there were no satellite pictures, so they're depending on the maps of those before them and the trust in that. There were no phones, satellite phones. There were no, you know, they were really out there.
Right. Yeah. Very few resources compared to the way ecological science gets done today. It was just them and these plant presses made out of newspaper and, you know, off they went trying to get the best answers that they could.
Now, another thing that I liked is that occasionally they would stop and then trek away from these canyons. And I was especially taken with them trekking off to Rainbow Bridge.
Right. Yeah. Rainbow Bridge is a spot in the Glen Canyon region. It's now kind of more on the shores of Lake Powell. But at the time, it was a bit of a hike away from the river. And that was one of the kind of rare occasions when they stopped and they really took the time to make a hike out of the river corridor. Elzeta, in her original proposal for this trip, intended to do a lot of that because she was very curious about what kind of plants lived in these like beautiful tributaries along the river. But of course, they were always late and they were always in a rush and they rarely had time for those kinds of hikes. So Rainbow Bridge was special. They all wanted to go see it. It's a sacred site to Navajo, Hopi, Paiute, and other tribes in this area. And it's a natural stone arch that's, I think, almost 300 feet tall. So it's really kind of an incredible place. And they, you know, you could tell that they really were interested in this region and they wanted to take the time to see it as much as they could.
Now, they just didn't start at the beginning and then go all the way to the end. There were a number of stopping places that they had planned on, and that way they could, you know, ship away some of these specimens as well as get more provisions and all that type of thing. And when they were late at one particular spot, it set off a national media frenzy. What does a national media frenzy look like in 1938?
Right. Isn't that fascinating? I was really just kind of enthralled by the newspaper articles covering this trip. They were supposed to arrive at Lee's Ferry, which is kind of the stopping point at the head of the Grand Canyon, on the 4th of July. And they didn't make it. And, you know, they have no idea. They have no contact with the outside world at this point. They're just, you know, headed down the river. And so they have no idea that the newspapers have picked up on their non-appearance and kind of blown it up into this like national disaster. So there were headline front page stories all around the nation talking about this lost expedition that hadn't appeared. The water was still quite high. And so there were, you know, stories of like federal employees who were watching the river for the wreckage that might come down, you know, like waiting to see the pieces of the boat float by. And there were stories about, the U.S. Coast Guard eventually went out and went looking for them. So it got quite serious. And the interesting thing about the newspaper articles was there was a lot of focus on the women, right? This was one of the rare attempts by women to go down this river. And, there was kind of a fixation on the fact that women were attempting this trip. And there was a lot of criticism of, you know, the idea that the trip had gone badly because the women were there. And so it was quite interesting to see that response. I think the newspaper coverage would not have been quite as hysterical, I would say, if the women hadn't been involved.
And TWA, which Transworld Airlines, which was a big airline at the time and is no longer with us, the TWA planes out of Los Angeles changed their route so they would fly over the area so that the passengers could see if they could see people or boats down there. Maybe they would discover them from one of these flights.
Right, right. It became kind of a national obsession. And yeah, I can just imagine all of those folks in the planes like craning their neck and looking out the window being like, can I see like a destroyed boat down there? You know, pretty, pretty crazy stuff.
Now, you did mention earlier the letters of Lois Jotter to her father. What other kinds of particular sources were you able to get to put this together?
Luckily for me, both women kept detailed diaries, and they had the foresight to preserve those diaries and donate them to universities. I think without that, I wouldn't have been able to tell this story. And they were wonderful writers. They were both very funny, you know, so their diaries were just full of these wonderfully rich details. There were several other diaries by some of the men on the trip, you know, and also these letters that they were writing. Anytime they got a chance to post a letter home and basically say, I'm safe, I'm alive, you know, they would do that. And so those also were just full of wonderfully descriptive details. And I'm really grateful for those archives, and I'm grateful for the universities and the libraries that kept and preserved those materials, because it was really just a joy to kind of dive into that and uncover this story that I think had been forgotten.
Now, do the cuttings of Elzeta Clover and Lois Jotter survive? Can we see them?
The plant cuttings?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So the plant cuttings that they took during that trip are archived at various herbaria around the country. I think almost a dozen different places around the country have samples of these plants that were collected in 1938. And that's really cool. You can actually see scans of them online if you search for them. You know, you can find scans of these pressed plants, and they're being preserved for research. It's kind of wonderful that we have these basically plant libraries where researchers now, if they have questions about certain plants or about what things look like back then, they could go look at these plants and sometimes study them with advanced techniques that weren't available at the time.
Now, you mentioned you took a similar journey down the river. How did going down the river affect you and affect your perspective on this story?
That's a great question. Yeah. As soon as I got the book contract, I kind of knew I was going to have to go run the Grand Canyon myself, and I was very nervous. That's not something that I had on my bucket list, to be honest. I am not a whitewater river rafter. I had never done a journey like that before. And so I joined a botany crew, actually. I wanted to see not only what it was like to experience the river, but also to have to do botany work along the way. And so I joined a crew that was weeding out an invasive species of grass, and we did a two-week trip through the Grand Canyon together. And it was an incredible experience. I think it was good that I was nervous. I think I was able to channel what Elzeta and Lois must have felt. You know, they were going into this with very little idea of what was ahead. No good maps, no good equipment. You know, the accounts that they had read of this journey were tended to be pretty exaggerated and pretty frightening. So it was incredible that they went anyway. And I think my nervousness helped kind of channel some of that. I definitely had a lot more idea of what I was getting into than they did, but I was still a little afraid. It was incredible. I mean, it's undescribable at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and experiencing it by river is very different than hiking through it, which I had done. There's something about traveling downriver that's just, you know, your entire world narrows down to this canyon with these high walls and this swift moving water, and the rest of the world kind of disappears and becomes very unreal while you're down there. And just being immersed in that was just an incredible experience.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you come back. See us again.
Thanks so much, Moira.
My guest today is Melissa Seveny. Her book is The Untold Story of Two Women Who Mapped the Botany of the Grand Canyon. It's published by W.W. Norton. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nochtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.